U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Senate makes a deal to move forward on a $550 billion infrastructure bill as the latest economic numbers show the U.S. back above the pre-pandemic waterline. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnist Bill McGurn and editorial writer Kate Batchelder Odell. On Friday, the Senate voted 66-28 to start debate on an infrastructure package. This bipartisan negotiation has been going on for weeks now. We've discussed it a lot. The total size of it is about a trillion dollars, and about $550 billion of that is new funding. And just to give a sense of what's in it, the White House fact sheet cites $110 billion for roads, bridges, major projects. $39 billion to modernize public transit, $66 billion for Amtrak, $7.5 billion to build a national network of chargers for electric vehicles, $65 billion for high-speed internet. Bill, what are your thoughts about this package overall?
Well, overall, I think the best you can say for it is that we avoided some of the worst. You know, it cut out the funding for the IRS and, I believe, an infrastructure bank. Things that, you know, I'd worry had a more permanent kind of funding stream for this. But I'm not enthusiastic, and I'm not enthusiastic for one very sort of general reason and one very specific reason. The general reason is because I think that a lot of people playing it up, especially the Republicans who supported it, do so on the idea that this is separate from the $3.5 trillion in spending that the president also wants to go through, or probably put through with reconciliation. And I think that's a fiction. I don't think Joe Biden thinks they're separate. I don't think Chuck Schumer thinks they're separate. And I do not think Nancy Pelosi thinks they're separate. So the real question for Republicans is, by passing this, their best argument was by taking the attractive parts of the spending to the American people, infrastructure. People are generally more positive about infrastructure than other stuff. By taking the most attractive aspects out of the larger spending, it would make it harder to do the reconciliation bill because that would have the less attractive spending. I'm not sure that's actually true. I think we're going to get both, although we might get a lesser figure. We might get $2.5 trillion or so forth. And then the second, kind of what you alluded to, I'm just skeptical that this is the best way, even if you didn't have that reconciliation bill. I'm just skeptical that a massive new influx of federal spending is the way to handle infrastructure. I think we have infrastructure needs. I think we need to be more clever about how we fund it and so forth, like roads and bridges. I think, you know, one of the ways we might be able to do a better job of it is instead of making people in Topeka, you know, fund mass transit in New York City with their tax dollars. I think that a lot of states could handle this, you know, if they made deals with the private sector. Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana was very good at this. You know, he privatized a road. And so the people who paid for it are the people who used it. And some of that money then was used for other infrastructure. So even if you just consider it on your own, I think it's very dubious. And I also think, I don't know if people really believe that it's going to be paid for with no problems. I mean, there's a lot of rosy assumptions in here. And anyone who remembers, you know, Shovel Ready should have a few doubts about this bill.
Well, I think that's a good point, Bill. I mean, maybe the interstate highways are a little bit trickier because they run through states. And so there are externalities, to use an economic term, for one state putting money into, you know, building or fixing a bridge on an interstate highway in a critical, you know, artery for traffic and for commerce. But I agree with you in general. I mean, why not let states handle a lot of this stuff? If there's a bridge that needs fixing in Minnesota, or if they're areas of West Virginia that need broadband. You know, you'd think the people in those states would know how to raise the revenue and know best where to direct the funds. You know, that said, some federal money on roads and bridges is not the end of the world. I would point to more some of these other projects. Amtrak, a big one. We know Joe Biden loves Amtrak. The White House fact sheet says that this deal will position Amtrak and rail to play a central role in our transportation and economic future. It will bring world-class rail service to areas outside the Northeast. I mean, come on. This is a huge country. And Kate, as far as I understand it, Amtrak routes outside of the East Coast are not competitive. They're not profitable. And it comes with the post office problem, which is that every time anybody suggests doing away with one of these long haul routes that don't carry their own weight, Congress goes ballistic. And so it's hard for me to see the argument for dumping a bunch of money into that stuff without doing any real reform of the agency.
Yeah, Kyle, definitely. I mean, the solutions on Amtrak have always been quite easy to see, but as you're describing, there's always been kind of a parochial opposition to reforming Amtrak to kind of service corridors of the country where their population centers really exist for people to use the service. One other thing I'd add from the conversation we were having about who should fund infrastructure is Bob Poole did a great op-ed for us earlier this year that people just don't understand how much private capital there is out there, especially among institutional investors, to finance infrastructure projects. And I know that the term private-public partnership makes eyes glaze over, but it is frustrating to treat sheer public spending, which is usually financed by debt or taxes. And I think that's how the spending will be financed in the end too, though we can talk about the kind of purported pay-fors. But there are other ways to finance this spending. This was not the only option.
Another thing I would pull out from the White House fact sheet is this spending on electric vehicle chargers. It's supposed to fund deployment of EV chargers along highway corridors to facilitate long distance travel and within communities to provide convenient charging where people live. That's from the White House fact sheet. And I guess the 2 points there I'd make, Bill, is that electric vehicles at the moment are expensive. They are by and large not working class, middle class modes of transport. And so this ends up being a subsidy paid by the people in Topeka that you were describing for all the people on the coast in California who can afford a Tesla. And then the second point I would make is that I understand that part of the goal of Biden's approach here is to change that and help make electric vehicles more competitive. But I also wonder whether the technology is not so immature that we're going to end up building a huge number of these chargers that don't get the use that they're supposed to and end up outmoded when the next round of technology comes around. I mean, I think of the huge box of old phone chargers that everybody has sitting in their basement. I don't know what you make of that, Bill.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And remember the light bulbs, you know, the curlicue light bulbs that we had before the LEDs came in and were invented. I think you're absolutely right on that. Look, and that's one of the other flaws in this. You know, if a city or a state decides to build a bridge or a road or some other piece of infrastructure, there's usually a pretty straightforward purpose, right? They want to ease congestion or make it easier for people to get from one place to another, or, you know, handle water issues, whatever it is. But, you know, with Joe Biden, it just seems that the idea is to throw as much money as you can at a whole host of things. And they're hoping not just for infrastructure. You know, he's talking, it's part of his Green New Deal to have green union, well-paying jobs and so forth. You know, it's one thing if the private sector is really sustaining that. It's another if the taxpayers are just going to be hit up for it. So you don't know what the priorities are. And the bigger it is and the further away from the actual site it is, I think the less likely you are to get what the people need. I mean, people are used to having projects take forever, held up. I mean, I think if I were in charge of the federal government, what I'd be looking to do is make it easier for cities and states to put up the infrastructure that they need. I mean, right now, you know, we supposedly got some progress on permitting. I don't think it was very big. So right now we have a lot of rosy assumptions. You know, in terms of the pay-fors, you know, there's some questions about the math there. You know, my favorite is this idea that we're going to get enough economic growth to generate $56 billion of savings from this infrastructure, a 33% return on the investment. I mean, I am willing to bet my house we're never going to see that. And it makes me nervous that we're approving this, because one of the problems is right now all these guys are going to approve it. How many are going to be around in 5 years, you know, when we have all the problems?
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Bill raised the question of how to pay for this bill. And all the headlines are saying that they've made the revenues and the spending match up so that all of this money is paid for, essentially. But I agree with Bill that there are some questions here about that. And I'll point to an analysis by the Committee for the Responsible Federal Budget. And they're pointing out that some of these pay-fors include reducing unemployment fraud, lowering prescription drug costs, reducing the tax gap through cryptocurrency information reporting, selling spectrum frequencies. And their analysis suggests that the money that will be actually raised by the provisions in this bill is only half of what they need to pay for it. So here's the line from this watchdog group. Though the bill also includes a number of real and important offsets, we believe they will ultimately raise or save a total of $200 billion to $300 billion, likely closer to $200 billion over a decade, unquote. Kim, what do you think about that kind of analysis?
Well, sure, Kyle. I mean, I think basically, so I'm looking at a list of pay-fors here, and some of them is they're going to reprogram some COVID dollars, and we're waiting on a score to find out what can reasonably be clawed back from unemployment. There are certainly fraudulently paid benefits there, but I have low faith in the government's ability to recoup them. One thing I wanted to really zero in on, because I think it really exposes the fiction that any of this is paid for, is this $49 billion for delaying a Medicare Part D rule. Now, I won't treat our listeners to an extended treatment of that rule. But the point is that the rule is not set to go in effect because it's tied up in court, and Congress is going to delay it even though the money won't be spent and claim savings on paper. So that's really a testament to the fact that you don't really have to pay for what you spend. You don't really have to make a choice about what government should and shouldn't be doing. You just have to work within these arcane budget rules to make the math look better on paper. So that is one of many gimmicks in this pay-for plan. Pension smoothing is another one. It's just, there are several hardy perennials here that really give you the impression that it is not a plan that is paid for. And to Bill's point, I don't think he's taking any great risk by betting his house that we won't see the $56 billion in economic growth. given a 33% return is a pretty optimistic estimate. So in short, Kyle, I mean, this is just a constant issue in Congress, which is just that they don't really have to account for their work. They just have to live within the confines of the Budget Act, and it continues to result in these kinds of bills.
So the Republican senators that are part of this this bipartisan group negotiating this and arguing that this is a good deal to pass, I mean, Bill, what are they really accomplishing, or what do they think they're accomplishing? I mean, the Journal's editorial today says sort of what you said at the outset, which is that the best part of this deal is what's not in it. There's no new taxes. There's no infrastructure bank. There's no bulking up of the IRS. As we've discussed on previous episodes, my concern there was just the privacy issue. Part of the Biden plan was to have banks report to the IRS the inflows and outflows of bank accounts, essentially huge numbers of bank accounts, given the ProPublica stories based on leaked or hacked IRS records. I question whether people want the IRS knowing more about their financial situations. But I mean, is that really it, Bill? Is the lack of those items in this bill really what the Republicans, these Republican senators, have gotten done?
I think you're right about that. And it's not a small achievement. I mean, it's a significant achievement because each of those items you rattled off are really awful and threaten to become permanent fixtures. But that said, I think the Republican proposition for this bill is based on, one, it would allow the Republican Party, which is the minority party now, and that doesn't control the White House, doesn't control the Senate, doesn't control the House. It would allow them to show that they're not just obstructionists. They're willing to go along and cooperate with the ruling party. That's one thing. Two, Americans generally, of all government spending, they kind of like infrastructure spending because unlike so much government spending, you at least see a bridge or a tunnel or something. Now, it may be very inefficient and so forth, but people, I think, at least think they've got something for their money that actually makes life better. So I think they're inclined to like that. If you look around your own neighborhood or your own state, you could probably think of a couple areas where you'd like to see some improvement. So I think those two are big things. And the third political argument for this is that by taking the good stuff, the stuff that there's bipartisan support for, the infrastructure, the physical bricks and mortars infrastructure that people like most, you make the rest of the Democratic package less appealing, the $3.5 trillion. So that's the bet. And I think we're going to see, the bet is if the Republicans sign on to this, they will prevent that $3.5 trillion bill from going through. It does not look to me as though that's happening. It looks like that is gathering steam. So that's a very clear bet that they make. I mean, Mrs. Pelosi, you know, has said she's not going to even consider this until we get the other bill through. So they're very serious about this. And it seems to me, you know, Republicans are kind of pretending this alternate reality where the two bills aren't linked. And it's going to be a very clear case of winners and losers. If the Republicans manage to defeat the reconciliation bill, then you could argue, okay, maybe this was a factor in it. But if they don't, I think they've lost an awful lot of things. I think for the reasons that Kate laid out, there's a lot of questions just on the substance itself of the infrastructure bill that make it a very doubtful proposition. I think more important, they lose it as an issue in next year's campaign and spending because the Republicans would have put their fingerprints on it and helped it through rather than stopped it. So I think it could be a very bad deal. And we're going to know one way or the other pretty quickly.
But there was a notable statement this week on this $3.5 trillion reconciliation package. It came from Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who is expressing some doubts, at least about that top line number. She said she will support beginning this process, but I do not support a bill that costs $3.5 trillion. And in the coming months, I will work in good faith to develop this legislation with my colleagues and the administration to strengthen Arizona's economy and so on and so forth. Kate, so what, I mean that's an interesting statement. I mean, that does not rule out voting for a $3.5 trillion bill necessarily. It does not rule out voting for a $2.5 trillion bill or something that would still be a massive expansion of entitlement programs. Kate, what's your read of the political dynamic here?
I agree with Bill entirely that I think wins beget more wins. And so Democrats will capitalize on having succeeded here to try to succeed on their $3.5 trillion project. I think also Sinema's statement was very interesting. But as you said, we have no idea whether she'd support a $2.5 trillion bill and call it moderate, which to me seems an entirely probable outcome since she's able to play kingmaker here and get what she would like out of it. I just think the pressure will be extremely intense on her to come up with something, given that the core of the $3.5 trillion project is healthcare spending and paid family leave or child care or child tax credits. And I think the progressive arguments against her for potentially stalling progress on those projects will be extremely intense. However, I do think the reconciliation process that they have to work with, since they can't, since they're not going to do it on a bipartisan basis, it does have some limits. And I think it'll be, it will be difficult to set up some of those entitlement programs, but I think ultimately they will be able to, you know, if set something up for a few years or try some of these programs, but not others. So maybe there is some programs that are left out. But I do think, per Bill's point, we are heading toward another very big Democratic success. And the question now is the magnitude.
The other big story on Thursday was the release of these new economic numbers. The gross domestic product report showed that the economy grew in the second quarter at 5.9%. Economy grew in the second quarter 6.5%, which was lower than about 8%, which economists had predicted. But Bill, notable that it was above the economy has now recovered above the point it was at when COVID hit last year. And it's true, there was trillions of dollars of relief spending pumped out there. A lot of it is still not spent. But that said, there was a lot of talk, last year, early this year, about this V-shaped recovery. And do you think that this is this what that looks like?
I don't think we know yet. I think what we do know is, look, there's a lot of pent-up demand and so forth. And I think the best stimulus for the economy is to let it open and let people do things. And we've been interfering in a whole host of ways, from unemployment benefits that give people an incentive to stay home rather than take a job. They're very rational incentives in a sense, people are not irrational. If they don't get much more for working, why would they work? So, and to prescribe this massive dose of public spending now, I just don't see the justification for it. But again, I think there's a big clash of visions. I think Joe Biden, if you read all his defenses of the spending, he seems to believe that economies are government led. You know, it's all about government investment. No one ever says government spending anymore. It's all investment, and that we need the government to do this. And I think quite the opposite. I think government has held people back. There are a lot of people. Look, the biggest complaint now is employers can't get workers, right? That's good. That's actually a good situation for workers, because it means they can be a little more choosy and that employers may have to pay them a little more. So workers are in a good position right now. And I think we're just we're threatening all that with all this spending and government intervention.
Yeah, it does seem that drawing workers back into the economy is becoming the harder thing to do. And the U.S. unemployment rate, this is the figure I was looking at earlier, is still at 5.9%. And there are still millions of workers who were in the economy last year and are not. And that is not only inducing employers to raise wages, it's also inducing them to improve their benefits. And there's this remarkable headline from Wednesday, CNN Business. America's largest retailer will cover 100% of college tuition for its workers. And not only that, there used to be a dollar a day fee for Walmart workers who were earning a degree, and they're doing away with that. This quote from the senior vice president: "We feel that eliminating the dollar a day investment removes the financial barriers to enrollment and will increase access." I mean, that's a really amazing headline to me. Anybody who is working part time at Walmart can essentially get tuition and books covered. I mean, what a time to be looking for a job.
Yeah, Kyle, I was looking at the survey data that came out from the National Federation of Independent Businesses recently, and I think it was about 45% of owners said they had job openings that they couldn't fill. And that was down a little bit from last month, but it was still far above its historical average of 22%. So I think it's a real testament to the difficulty that that businesses are having finding workers. And I'd also add, we're starting to see some data out of states that have declined the unemployment bonus from the federal government versus ones that haven't, and what trend that might be having on their unemployment claims. It's very hard to draw causative conclusions from data like this, given the many different factors of states. But it's starting to look like that is also helping helping states who do turn that money down. It is helping getting their workforce, back looking for jobs and back back getting those jobs that are offering these great benefits.
And the anecdotes seem to fit that. I mean, here was the other headline that I was going to point to. McDonald's says jobs coming back fastest in states that ended extra unemployment benefits. It cites the CEO on an earnings call who's saying it's a challenging staffing environment. But essentially that the states that ended the federal unemployment bonus are doing better. And so, Bill, we've talked about this too on previous podcasts, and I guess the proof is in the pudding here, but isn't that what we ought to have expected?
Yes, I think it's exactly what we have expected, but that doesn't seem to matter in any of these calculations. I think all this stuff, if you take the accumulated weight of it, seems to me to should make us less optimistic and so forth, and not willing to look over these things before we unleash all this money. But it seems to be having the opposite purpose. I mean, I don't know what your read is, but my read is that actually objections to the other bill are subsiding. Kate mentioned Kyrsten Sinema, who's objected to the $3.5 trillion figure, but not necessarily to the bill. And I think it leaves Republicans in a terrible position, because if it's $2.5 trillion, we've got all this spending, and the Republicans will say, well, we saved you from, there would have been more. I think Republicans would have been better keeping the issue of spending integrity, for the next election. So I'm afraid I'm really pessimistic about the whole enterprise.
Thank you, Bill and Kate. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.